Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and I'm joined by someone I admire tremendously in this industry, the one and only Blake Murphy of Sportsnet. Now I can call you a colleague, which is kind of cool to say, who covers everything from the Raptors and Blue Jays. What's it been like this year for you? You're covering you have your own show with Matt Bonner and everything. And what's that dynamic been like for you in covering a team that's been interesting, but also in a pretty big tank mode at the same time.
Yeah, well, first of all, nice to chat with you again. Thanks for having me. Thought I if you had told me at the start of the season when you first got the Sens gig that I'd come on with you, I thought I would get to do the like tongue-in-cheek burial of the Senators. Did not think they'd be 1 point out of a playoff spot. So, good for you. Glad I hope that means a few more eyeballs on your work and stuff like that. But man, I guess the Senators being like just a little bit better is still kind of you can poke fun at them, but not quite.
Yeah, you can. You can. A little bit. We'll see. If they miss out by like 2 points, well, there will be a lot of Brady Kachuk jokes. That's kind of upon their horizon. That's
Yeah,
for
they're trying to get into that like Brooklyn Nets tier
sure.
of what
It's
if we're too good for the best pick? And
yes.
anyway, look, that the truth is about the Raptors show this year. The Matt Bonner side has been awesome. Like I loved working with Will and Alex. I loved working with Kareem back in the day. Getting to pick the brain of a guy who played 12 years in the NBA every day is awesome. Like coming in before the show and breaking down film together before we go on air, or hearing him relate some of his own experiences to what the Raptors are going through. It's been super. It's made me a smarter basketball observer. It's something that, as much as there's a really, really great podcast and blog presence in the city of Toronto around basketball, there weren't any ex-player voices in that really. Paul Jones has been around a long time as a coach, and we obviously have Alvin on the broadcast and stuff like that. But from a daily perspective, I don't know that we really had that before. So that's been cool. Having said all that, does make you a little bit insane, having to cover 82 games where no matter what happens, there are going to be a bunch of people yelling at you about tanking is the scourge of the earth and anyone who believes in it should be not be allowed to be a fan when the team's good again, et cetera. And then some people who are like, tanking is the only thing. Anyone who doesn't want it is a moron. And so like you get these things where like you tweet about some positive progress a guy's making and it's like, yeah, but it's costing them losses, or you tweet a negative thing. It's like, who cares? They're tanking. That part about it, like, I absolutely understand the fans who want to be fans and want to root for the team every day and don't believe in tanking, or, hey, it's an entertainment product and this is 177 days out of my year. I don't want to root for losses. And I understand the people who are like, all I care about is the team being great again, not being decent. What I have struggled with a little bit is when those two things kind of blend together into this like nihilism of like nothing that happens on the court actually matters. And like that's what I care about the most. Like I have a daily show. I want to talk about how you blew a 16-point fourth quarter lead to the Bulls. I don't want to just be like it would be a pretty boring show if we were just like, well, that's a tank win. So that part of it's been challenging because again, I think either fan perspective is justified. I could see the logic with both sides, and there's no right or wrong way to do it. But it has, day to day, it's made the actual breaking down of the games feel a little less important, which kind of sucks because that's my favorite part.
No, the one thing I will say is, at least as a casual fan or observer, is that it felt like the first 2 or 3 months of the season, even though they were losing a bunch of games, they were like super exciting. And even now, I feel like I'll put on a Raptors game, and it's quite ex like it, they're playing decent basketball. Obviously, there's a lot of losses in there, but it's not a lot of like 40 point games and stuff like that. Like, when you look at this season, and obviously it's coming to its conclusion, like, what are maybe your takeaways from this Raptor season, apart like from wherever the lottery balls land in a couple months?
Yeah, I think there are a couple things, and probably the most notable in terms of how we're going to look at this moving forward is that they've signaled a little bit that they don't want to be like this for very long, right? Like the Ingram acquisition kind of tells us the ending to this rebuild story pretty quickly. But within that, there are things we can evaluate. And Scottie Barnes is obviously the team's most important player. offensively, at least statistically, a bit of a plateau season, but I think has unquestionably established himself as an all defense caliber guy. Whether he gets it or not probably depends more on the team's record and if he plays 65 games and stuff, but the level of defense is there. Some of the leadership stuff, the communication stuff has taken a step forward as well, so that's good. And then I think probably the biggest thing, if you are looking at what it would look like if the Raptors got back to being very good again, not just, next year. Hey, you add Brandon Ingram to this and a top pick and you're healthier. Like, obviously this team's going to win a fair number of games, but if we're talking about getting back to meaningfully good, something that has happened this year that hadn't happened the last few years and was a key piece of their build up to the championship is they hit on at least a couple of these draft picks and undrafted guys. Sorry, we got a cat attacking the webcam here.
Hey, buddy.
So, when you if you come out of a draft where your highest pick was 19th and you get one rotation caliber guy out of that draft year, you're feeling pretty good. The Raptors right now feel very good about Jacoby Walter at 19. I think you feel pretty solid about Jamal Shedd at 45. Jamison Battle has turned himself from an undrafted guy to a two-way to a guy on a multi-year contract now. Jonathan Mobo's had ups and downs, but certainly shown flashes worthy of a second-round pick. And then you've got Ulrich Strompshay, who prior to the knee injury was making really nice strides, particularly defensively with the G League team. That's a longer-term project, but you look at that, and it's really not hard to imagine that 2 years from now, two guys from this draft class are in the rotation permanently. And that is, again, when your top pick in the draft was 19th and it's supposed to be a bad draft, that's a pretty good outcome. So if they can get back to that, that's where they're not going to be a team that goes out and signs the biggest name free agent. They're going to have to be opportunistic and make a trade like a Kawhi trade, whether that's KD this summer, or Giannis in 2 summers, or Joel, whatever's left of Joel Embiid's knee cartilage, whatever. They're going to have to be a little opportunistic like that. And one of the things that was interesting to reflect on over the last couple of years is, when a KD becomes available, and I use KD as an example just because he's always on the trade market. You could, yes, trade Scottie Barnes and whatever for Kevin Durant, but then you have nobody left for Kevin Durant to play with. And what made the Kawhi trade so fascinating was they had built up, they had stacked these wins on top of each other, right? Like, they had found Fred VanVleet as an undrafted guy, turn him into a second round value, turn him into a first round value. They found Pascal Siakam at number 27, developed him into a lottery value, developed him into like a top five value. Jakob Poeltl at number 9, DeLon at 20, Norm in the second round. You take all of these. Even, I mean, this was a little at the tail end of that, but Chris Boucher, as a discarded two-way guy, becomes a 7-year rotation player. Those little things are not going to determine if you win a championship, but you stack a bunch of them and you turn a nickel into a dime and two dimes into a quarter and three quarters into a dollar and so on. Then you are in a position where if you trade for Kawhi, not only do you have extra pieces so you could do a consolidation trade like that, but you have more pieces if you need to do a Marc Gasol trade. And you still have an 8-man deep rotation, a 9-man deep rotation. So I'm not saying all of that doesn't get done in a year. The Raptors did that over like the 2015 to 2019 or 2015 to 2018 drafts. But I think it's a really important thing if they get back to that. And, we can't put Jamal Shedd on the Fred VanVleet all-star trajectory yet. It wouldn't be fair to put that on him. But, I don't think it's hard to see two, maybe even three of the guys from this draft class working out as NBA roster players. And that's that'd be a pretty big win and really what you're looking for in a kind of rebuild slash development year.
Yeah, and with that, like obviously you talked about the BI trade, and obviously the extension at the same time. Like that feels like, a lot of p fans loved it or hated it at the same time, the move. But from my perspective, it's almost like, well, you've definitely gotten better, but how much better has the team got? Like when you see that big picture, right? Like what do you make of that trade and what it means for the team moving forward?
Yeah, I think, how much better is also going to depend on some factors not related to Brandon Ingram. Like the fact that, for one, you're going to be trying to win games next year. Does that mean the rotations are a little more optimized? Does that mean Jakob Poeltl's hit pointer costs him 2 games instead of 5 games and little things like that? So those things kind of cascade. I think if you look at this team, you certainly can't project like perfect health for next year, right? But they went a big chunk of the season with no Bruce Brown and no Kelly Olynyk, who not the, franchise altering, but steady vets who, if you have those guys, we saw it even when they won 5 of 8 in that one stretch before the deadline. We saw it. You were going to win a couple extra games with those guys. Jamal Shedd has played the most games on the team, and he's missed 6 games. Most of that is, rotation decisions, but nobody's played more than 55 games. RJ's missed 13. Jakob's missed 13. Scotty's missed 14. Quickly's played, what, 22? So not that Brandon Ingram has been like the pillar of health, but you also are factoring in this team's going to be a little bit more healthy. They are playing one of the youngest rotations in the league right now. Those guys will be a little better. I don't think it's unrealistic to look at what they have right now, add in a top five, hopefully, pick in the draft, and be like, look, this team's goal should be next year not only to make the play, but like avoid the play, like be a top six team in the Eastern Conference. And that might be a little lofty, like jumping from, say they finish with 27 wins this year to 45 is a really big jump. Right now the Pistons have so the Pistons are on pace for like 47, 48 wins as a sixth seed. So maybe the sixth seed's just a tad too high, but you go into the season and maybe that's your goal, right? So I think, and the other part of this is they are back to being built in a way where if one of those opportunistic trade comes up, they are better positioned to make one of those moves. I'm not saying you extended Ingram to turn around and like make him the piece of a KD trade or anything like that, but this front office, they'll call on those guys or whatever. So I think, sorry, I'm gonna sneeze here in a second.
No.
But I think it's reasonable to target the playoffs again next year.
I'll kind of save you
Sorry,
from
man.
no, that's okay. With that in mind, right? Like you talked about maybe players that they can trade in potentially a bigger deal. Like, do you think they're like, is that where their mindset's at right now, where it's like, hey, this summer, or do you feel like it's almost building, as you said, to maybe in a year or two from now when.
Yeah, I don't think you can be that explicit about it. I think what they are in is what I would call, and I don't like talking about players this way, but from a, organizational standpoint, it's about asset building, right? And that's, like I said, turning an undrafted into a second round value, turning a second round value into a first round, Jacoby into a lottery value, whatever. They, in their eyes, I think they turned a first round pick, an expiring contract, and a guy that everyone loves in Kelly Olynyk, but it's pretty expensive next year at like 13, 14 million. They turned that into Brandon Ingram. So if you look at what was on this roster this year, they what? Bruce Brown played 18 games at 20 minutes a game. Kelly played 24 games at 16 minutes a game. And that is all they lost off the roster to add Brandon Ingram, who at one point was an all-star. And everyone I talk to in the organization thinks they can get him back to being an all-star caliber player. Work on the body, work on some of the, shot distribution stuff, get the defense back up to a level it should be with his tools. And maybe this guy's an all-star again. So, I think that's they make that move not just because they like the player, but it's a way to turn, again, a bunch of nickels into a quarter. Now, how you feel about that Pacers pick next year probably determines whether you agree with that thinking from the front office or not. If you think the Pacers could be bad next year, or next year's draft is really good, or that you could have done something better with that first round pick, maybe you disagree with the front office's thinking. But I think they looked at, hey, what are these three assets worth? What could Brandon Ingram be worth? And three nickels into a quarter, three quarters into a dollar, however you want to, if you want to phrase it. So flowing from that, they're heading into this offseason where all the pieces don't necessarily fit on court. And certainly under the constraints of the luxury tax, if they don't want to be a tax team, something's got to give somewhere in here. But I don't think that they feel the need to immediately solve that because it's going to be their first year back to being competitive. I think the fan base would be, pretty thrilled about a move back to the playoffs and potential to win a playoff series and stuff like that. You also, all these guys that you have, like other than Brandon Ingram, the whole core is young. I guess Jakob Poeltl's 29 too, but like Scottie Barnes, still young. RJ, quickly, Grady Dick, Jacoby, whoever they draft in the top five this year, all those guys are
Five.
young. So you've got some time to build with it. So, I certainly get when I do my cap breakdown after the deadline, and everyone's like, does this mean RJ's getting traded? Does this mean Quickly's getting traded? The answer is like, probably eventually someone will go, but I don't think they feel they need to answer it today. They don't feel they need to answer it July 1st. Maybe it's next year's trade deadline. Maybe it's the next offseason. I don't think you have to answer that question kind of right this second.
I guess with that, like, who do you think is like, obviously Scotty Barnes is untouchable, but like moving forward and like the pathway for this team to be competitive, like what players do you see on this roster from like Quickley, RJ, in terms of players that you think that are kind of ready to be part of the team moving forward, and maybe someone that they can trade out because of the luxury tax, but also just because of the fit on court.
Yeah, I think, from a purely on-court fit standpoint and, what their value could be, what the next deal looks like, RJ feels like the likeliest odd man out. You've, drafted and developed some off guards here. And RJ, it's tough, right? Because like you acquire RJ from the Knicks and the word like toxic asset gets thrown out there and you like the guy and suddenly he gets your program and things start clicking, right? Like the playmaking takes a huge leap. The
Oof.
scoring efficiency ticks up and then it dips back down when teams catch on. Then it comes back up again, which is like, okay, maybe he's figured out that next level. The last 15 or 20 games, I'm still not as high on his defense as some have come around the last 20 games, but it's unquestionably been a little bit better, right? Like the back cuts are down, he's engaging a little bit more one-on-one and things like that. So it's a difficult thing to then turn around and be like, cool, we improved the value of this guy. Now he's the odd man out. Let's go trade him. But that's it's the reality of the business sometimes. And I do think that when you look at how all the pieces fit, it is easier, even though Emmanuel Quickley is getting $32 million, this move would make it less likely that he's worth $32 million. But if you're looking at how all the offensive pieces fit, Emmanuel Quickley suddenly becoming just like a monster off-ball three-point shooting threat is a way to make the Ingram Scotty dynamic work in a way that if RJ, Scotty, and Ingram are all on the floor together, I don't know how the ball share works out. Now, you could RJ's the first sub out and he runs the bench unit and stuff. There are ways to make it work, and this is why I say I don't think it's a decision they need to make today or July 1st. But for those reasons and because RJ's extension eligible this offseason, I would lean toward he's the odd guy out. I think Scotty's the only guy that's like truly untouchable. And then like, if you want to win next year, Jakob is like borderline untouchable just because like they're what, like 2-11 without him, and they just went like minus 30 over 48 minutes with him over two games that they almost blew. They gotta, that's the one of it is like whatever they do in the draft and free agency and stuff like that, they gotta start developing a second big man at some point because Jakob can't be the world's oldest 29-year-old forever.
I guess with that, and you mentioned Scotty, like how do you view his ceiling like after this season, or as the season has progressed? Like obviously, last year he became an all-star, he really took a step. His counting stats this year haven't really improved, but his defense definitely has at the same time. Like, where do you, like, I guess this is probably a dumb question, you've been asked this many times, but like, do you see him as the best player on a championship level team? Is it the second best? Like, where do you see his ceiling?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's even necessary really to put a ceiling on him yet. I think, this is year four, right? And this is the year that you want guys to start taking the leap. But there's a reason you get the big contract in year five. There is like Cade Cunningham is taking that leap this year. Pascal took his big leap in year four, but that's not universal. Some guys take a little bit longer. I think again, Scottie's defense this year has like unquestionably. Hey, he's always shown good flashes. He's always been a good defender. But now it's like, no. When the game matters and he's locked in, like there are very few guys as good and as versatile as him defensively. Offensively, I would hear the argument that, yeah, we should be a little concerned. He got, more share of the offense. They oriented things more around him being a point guard, and none of the counting stats have really changed. And some of the efficiency numbers are even down, like his scoring efficiency, his ability to get to the rim and things like that. However, we've also seen from this player that this happened already. This happened in his second season. It was like, oh, everyone's got the book on Scotty Barnes now. His efficiency's down. Maybe he's just a transition and offensive rebounds and dunker spot kind of guy. And then he figured it out. So, it's not a lock that that'll happen. He obviously is going to need to either pocket some of the 3-point attempts or become a better 3-point shooter. He's gonna have to find a way to get to the rim more. I love the 15-foot. I'm gonna take my guy to the elbow, bully him off, and hit a fadeaway. Like, that's an absolutely necessary counter to have if you're gonna be a star level scorer. But it probably shouldn't be the number one source of your offense. But he's not a finished product. It's year four. It's really, year 1.5 of him fully having the reins. I think it's entirely realistic that he could come back next year and it looks like his year three, where, all the stuff that troubled him in year two, he's started to figure out with the benefit of time and an offseason. Now, having said that, when you get to this level, each subsequent improvement you're going to make is harder and harder, right? Like, you the net this is why, like, most improved player is always such an interesting thing, because it's like Ty Jerome is making the biggest jump in terms of, like, he went from the 450th best player in the league to the, I don't know, 120th or whatever the number is. I'm just throwing a number out there, probably not 120th, but that is a huge jump in terms of numbers. But, like, if Tyrese Maxey were healthy all year and the Sixers have been good, that little jump, Cade's little jump from, like, he's probably pretty good to, like, oh, he might be all NBA. Like, that is a more valuable jump and a more difficult jump. So, I'm curious to see. In terms of Scotty, like, if you were speaking only probabilistically, it's likelier that Scotty is not the best player on a championship team than he is, because there are only like 10 of those guys in the league at a given time, if that, right? Like, even right now, you'd probably draw the cutoff at fewer than 10 in terms of, like, I feel like I'm a contender with only this guy. That puts you in a position where you're hoping for Cooper Flagg and hope that he develops, or you're trying to add Brandon Ingram and Emmanuel quickly so that you have four guys who can kind of share the load and you don't have to have that. And the fact that Scottie's the best passer at his position and the best defender, the overall value gets to, say, third team all NBA level. Like, Jimmy Butler's an interesting comp, and him and Scottie don't really, like, necessarily play all that similarly. But if you look at the history of the recent history over the last 15 years or so of guys who made all NBA without being like a star level usage guy, like 28, 29, 30% usage, Jimmy Butler's name pops up all the time. It's like, well, how do you do it? Well, be efficient in like 25% usage, be an absolute dog defensively, have enough playmaking to matter, and have that switch that you can flip when it's necessary. So, like, there are paths to being an all NBA level guy that aren't just like go get 25 points a game on 60% true shooting. So I don't know. I don't want to. This is like I don't. It's not even a cop out answer, because this is how player development works. But I don't want to box him in and say he can't be the best guy on a really good team, or this year's it. It showed that he can't improve from that point forward. I don't think it's realistic given what we know about player development and what we've seen from Scotty in the past. So yeah, I'm not putting a cap on it, really. I think he'll be better than he was this year, next year offensively. And then that's probably a guy that if this team wins 45 games and he's 10% better offensively next year, probably talking about him in the third team all NBA mix.
I guess for you, like, how do you, what's the calculus that you think will change for this Raptors organization if they do move up in the draft? Not just for Cooper Flagg, but to, I know it's a hypothetical, but I'm just kind of curious, like, what you see as what kind of the dynamic changes after if the Raptors were to move up in the draft lottery.
Yeah, I think, are we talking up to number one?
Sure, let's do that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, like, we're talking right now, that's a 10.5% chance with where they are in the standings right now. That's enough of a chance to be to worth talk about. That wasn't a real sentence, but bear
That's
with
okay.
me. So yeah, I mean, I think Cooper Flagg is interestingly like the highest floor and highest ceiling guy in the draft. So right away, you're like, okay, we thought we could be good this year. Now we've got very few rookies come in and drive winning right away. We got one of the ones who might. And that's really important. Positionally, you have an idea who the two players who are untouchable are. So when you're thinking about things like, well, how do all the pieces fit? Who's the odd man out or whatever? You know, two of those spots are locked in. Scottie Barnes and Cooper Flagg are in that starting lineup every day for the next 5 years or 9 years or whatever it works out to. And then, from there, you can start to make marginal moves that are focused on, I don't want to say win now, because, like, you don't start selling first round picks, or trading seconds to get out of luxury tax the way you did in the championship year, because like
Mm-hmm.
Kawhi was a veteran free agent and your roster was kind of old. You had some young guys, but the roster was older. This would be a case where you're in win now mode, where you're in win now mode carefully, because your win now, win over the next 4 years of Scottie Barnes' deal, win over the next 9 years of having Cooper Flagg. It puts you in a really fun position where a lot of options open up. A lot of roster building things, a lot of, hey, we could take this gamble because the floor is really high, we've got a runway and things like that. That gets cool. Now, the 89.5% where that doesn't happen, it's interesting. This is, and I think the biggest spot where the Ingram trade signals a change in appetite is, I think if they got Cooper Flagg with or without Ingram, they would want to win next year. I think they would be like, look, we did the tanking thing, we got our guy, just like with Scottie in the Tampa year. Let's get the hell out of this bottom of the East. Let's play ball. This front office doesn't want to lose. They don't like to lose. I don't. Nobody likes to lose. So that was going to happen regardless. Where it gets really interesting is not even in the like, what if they land 2, 3, 4, 5 range? Because everyone says it's a really good draft. You're going to get a good guy pretty much anywhere in the top 8 or 9. I really like Dylan Harper. Vijay Edgecombe's cool. The Lithuanian kid, Ace Bailey is a long. Ace Bailey's like in a little pocket of his own because he's going to be probably really good, but going to take a little while to get there. So where I think the Ingram acquisition changes the accounting and changes the thinking is, let's say they land 7, 8, and the guy they get is good, but either a couple years away, like an Ace Bailey, one of the centers who, if they're going to develop into a starting center, is probably going to take a little bit of time to get there. One of the European guys that's going to take an adjustment, Traore or whoever it is, it's going to take a little bit of time. Before they made the Ingram trade, I would have played out the possibility of like, okay, what if they run this back and do the same thing next year? What if they look at the market for Jakob Poeltl in the offseason, pick up another pick, embrace losing games again, and again, probably not Washington Charlotte level bad, but hey, the goal is not to win and make the playoffs just yet. Now that they have Ingram in there, now that they've traded away a first round pick for that, I don't think that's a possibility. I think if they get the 7 or 8 pick, you add that guy, you hope it works out, you worry about the medium term development still, but you're done doing this. You still want to play. So that's where it gets, that's the uncomfortable spot there with not only with this Ingram deal, but with the where they are in terms of building back up is, okay, what if you get a guy that you like but you don't love and you think is a long-term rotation piece but not a franchise cornerstone? That's where it gets just a little awkward at this point. And the odds of that are, what did I say, number 7 or number 8? We got like a 35% chance where things stand right now. So 10% chance we're all doing backflips and rainbows and kittens and stuff. 35% chance we're like, how's this work out? Or there's also the case too, they just like hit on a guy at 7 or 8 who rocks, which is entirely possible as well.
How much trust do you have in Masai and Bobby in terms of drafting up? They had a kind of couple of years of misses, or Malachi Flynn, but nothing major. They hit the Scotty Barnes pick as well. Obviously, Grady Dick's done really well, especially in his second year. Like, how much level of trust do you have in this organization where it feels like the fans were like nothing they could do would be wrong, then everything they do is wrong, and now it feels like they're coming back a little bit, but people still
Yeah,
a bit of.
I don't. I think either of those answers is too extreme, right? Like this is a front office that has drafted and developed really well. They have a couple misses. The Malachi Flynn one, I wasn't sure about it at the time. I really wanted Desmond Bane. Malachi Flynn's back in the league now on a 10-day at least. Shout out to him. And like, look, they're like cold spell. It was like they didn't really have any picks, right? Like 2019, they had the 59th overall pick. They got the Juan Hernandez. They liked O'Shea Brissett and Shamorie Ponds and a couple other guys. It turns out there probably wasn't a great answer at the 59th pick there. The 2020 draft was like the COVID draft. So you get Malachi Flynn and Jalen Harris, not your best work. And then you get Scottie, and you also had two mid-second round picks. David Johnson didn't become anything, but look at what D'Lon O'Bannon has turned into. Really, it didn't happen with you, but really great pick for the 46th overall pick to get a guy. And then the year after that, they only had the number 33 pick, and Christian Koloko looked like a good pick at 33 until he missed an entire year, and he's in the weird Lakers vortex now. So we'll see if that if that turns out. But like, that's what did we just go through? 2 years of bad drafting where they, or 3 years because they didn't even have a pick in 2018. So a 3 year dry spell where one of the years was COVID, the highest pick they had was 29. Whatever, you can understand a cold spell like that. It's like Clayton Kershaw having like a 4 year or a 1 year. But then otherwise they've been pretty solid. So I have a good confidence level. The nature of me doing the Jay show all summer has meant that the last 2 or 3 drafts I haven't been able to be as locked in as I normally was. Like that like 2014 to 2021 era, I had like draft profiles up on like 70 different guys. Like if there was a chance they were getting drafted, I had a little blurb on them and stuff, and I had an opinion on everyone. 2023, 2022 is like nothing because they only had a second round pick and I was doing that Jay show for the first time. And then 2023, okay, they have 13. I focus on the lottery guys. They didn't have a second round pick. Last year I was a little bit more, tuned in because it was going to be a big draft year and things like that. There was also the potential that they had kept their pick. It didn't convey. But I don't get to be like quite as locked in as I was when I was only doing Raptors. And that why I say that is that 2014, 2015 to 2021 range, we'll say, I felt very confident, calling the shot in the air, right? Like when a ball gets out of a guy's hand, you should say if that was a good shot or not. You shouldn't wait until wait. Like, it, did the offense produce a good shot? Should he have shot that? You call in the air. You don't wait to see if it drops. And that's how I felt about my ability to kind of evaluate the front office with their draft picks there. Liked Scotty, liked Delano. Didn't love David Johnson. Didn't love Malachi Flynn. What I loved OG. I think I was like 50-50 on Delon at that point. I think there were a couple guys that I liked a little better, but whatever. Now I feel like I have to do like a little bit more results analysis, which is fine and it's part of the job. I don't feel as confident criticizing them now as I did when I was like super locked in on it. This is needless. I'm just sharing too much about the nature of the job, but like the draft stuff is really hard. And I feel like I have lost a little bit of the right to question over the last
I
couple
guess,
summers.
being so locked in with the draft for almost a decade and see, kind of feeling out the hits and misses, like, why do you think the Raptors have been so good, it seems like, at drafting? And like everyone says, it's kind of a crapshoot, but there's some teams tend to be better than others. Like, why do you think of teams are better than others?
Yeah, look, game of crap still has odds, right? You could still play well or play poorly. So it's there are a couple things in there. I think there were a couple instances where they zigged when other teams were zagging. At the kind of first boom of what we'll say analytics-oriented front offices, one of the things that a lot of models did, as I understand it, is dinged older players. So hey, you're DeLon Wright, you're older at Utah, you're Pascal Siakam, you're older at New Mexico State, you're Norm, you did 4 years at a major program. Well, when we look at the entire history of basketball, guys who are older, guys who are in college dominating 18-year-olds, that is, not as projectable. We're not appreciating the 23-year-old beating up the 18-year-old as a sign that he's going to be a really good NBA player. He might be. Jaime Jaquez was a more recent example, right? Is he going to keep improving, or is he just day one going to be who he is? And I think in that kind of 2015, 2016 time, the Raptors embraced that a little bit. It's like, hey, this guy's a little older. Maybe that means the ceiling isn't going to develop as crazy high. But in DeLon's case, almost no chance he's not a solid rotation player. In Pascal's case, there was underlying stuff of like, well, okay, that's his, birth certificate age, but it's not his basketball age. It's a little different. In OG's case, that was there's a little bit of luck there. Like the injury red flags scares people off, and he should not have slid to 23, and no one thought he should slide to 23. So that one, that kind of tells itself. And I think the other important thing is, and this is as much on the player development side with, Boucher and Fred VanVleet and Pascal and Scotty Barnes and guys like that, is they've kind of taken a like why not philosophy with some of these guys. And that's more once they get them in house, but like, okay, this is what the guy is. This is what history tells us a 6 foot point guard can and can't do. But why not? Why can't he do a little bit more? Why can't we figure it out? Oh, a 6'9" power forward who was like a hustle and rebound guy getting 20-10 at a smaller school, that's not going to project. He can only be an energy guy at the NBA. Well, why? Why can't he have the ball in a little bit in his hands a little bit more? Why can't we, work on the dribble package and give him a spin move and stuff like that? Now, a lot of teams look at it like that, and some of it is your team situation. If you're the Denver Nuggets of the last couple of years, you probably had to draft more for certainty. We only get a couple kicks at this. We need guys who could be in the rotation around Nikola Jokic. We can't take a swing on a guy with a ton of upside who's going to take 4 years to get there. So the Raptors were in a position in those years where they were able to do that, but I think they did it pretty well. I think not putting ceilings on guys. There's also a component of, and the Raptors can't talk about this. No one can talk about this. Like, no team can openly. But one of the things that I do know that teams around the league try to figure out is there are two kind of psychological components that are black boxes, and one is developmental capacity. If you shoot the ball this way, and in our pre-draft workout, and I tell you, no, try it this way, and the next 10 shots you take, you do exactly what I said, and they don't drop, but you stick with it. Can you do that? Can you take coaching? Can you apply it to your skill stuff? Can you learn on the fly? Can you pick up, like Jamal Shedd had a banger of a film session with Darko at his
Really?
pre-draft workout. That was a big selling point. So you could the guess that Jamal Shedd will be able to pick things up, at least on the mental side, was there. Can you pick things up on a physical side? Can Ochai learn to shoot, even though for multiple years it showed, hey, he probably can't shoot? Things like that. So that's one component of it. The other one is, and this was one I remember hearing about Norm at the time, is how will you respond to success or failure, and how will you respond to not playing? Like, Norman Powell got drafted into a Raptors team that was supposed to be pretty good, and he was a second round pick, and he had just spent 2 years starting at UCLA. That's a big program. He was a really big call and a very good college player. What is this guy going to do if we ask him to go to the G League, or he's the 12th man on a good team and things like that? And he had 2 years at UCLA where he was a bench guy and embraced that and worked. And they made the bet that no, this will motivate this guy. It's going to push him to keep getting better. He's not going to withdraw. He's going to use this to, he's going to take the right approach to that. So those are things that, like, certainly I can't know. Like, I don't get to talk to these guys at that deep a level. I don't think teams even really know, but I do think they try to approximate that stuff and figure out, how is this guy going to learn on the fly, and how is this guy going to respond to, hey, we're a tanking team this year, and that's changed the competitive environment here, or hey, we're win now, and this guy might not play a lot, and he's going to have to go win a 905 championship. I think that's a hard thing to lock down, but something that they've tried to do fairly well.
Is that something where the teams have like sports psychologists, or is this just kind of gut trying, like something that, Bobby Masai or just even scouts have kind of picked up on in terms of the past decade or so?
Yeah, I'm sure they have people, like they have performance psychology staff. It's something that the coaches, like I would imagine, I'm not sure who runs their draft workouts now, but JAMA used to run them. So I would imagine he had some input on, like, hey, we tried to coach this guy up on this. He took to it or he didn't take to it. So it's a group thing there. I don't know that they are like, hey, can we run this guy through a bunch, like a Rorschach test and a bunch of psychological tests like that? But I think you want to get to know the player from a on court, off court, film room. Yeah, the performance, I forget exactly, mental performance or performance psychology, whatever they term that department. Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating thing. And like, obviously that's something teams don't talk about a ton because it's trade secrets, and also because there's like a privacy element with that kind of stuff with players, but I'm fascinated by it.
No, that's because I remember reading Grange's story, I think last year, on Grady Dick, about how he was essentially not that worried about his kind of ability to rebound because of his work ethic that seemed to be quite innate. And I found that really interesting. And then you could see that at the end of the tail end of last year, and then even this year, where he had the great start, and even he's had a really good sophomore year. The last Raptors question before I let you go. It's just like, how would you assess, like, there's been a lot of talk within the Raptors sphere about Darko Rajakovic's coaching ability. Like, how would you assess this season for him and how he's maybe evolved as a coach?
Yeah, he's he's similarly difficult to evaluate, right? Because if you want to nitpick some of the stuff, the team context maybe informs some of it, right? Like, hey, I don't really like this rotation decision. Why is this guy playing more than that guy? Well, the answer might be because wins and losses don't matter quite as much, and the player development is first. And even things like Scotty's offensive package, right? Like his shot profile. Is it is Darko encouraging that because he believes a 16-foot fadeaway is the best shot on the floor, and that should be Scotty Barnes' offense, or is he enabling him to develop that because he's going to need it as a counter down the line? It doesn't really matter all that much right now if they win 25 versus 23 games. Those kind of things are hard. I will say I would say I've been able to glean one positive and one negative from Darko so far. And it's important to note that I don't think coach, like once a game starts, I don't think coaches tank really. I think, Jakob Poeltl's under a minutes restriction. Hey, we want to get this guy this many minutes. There's maybe like a little bit of that in terms of who plays and who plays when they lay out the rotations. But a coach is not like, I'm making this challenge with the intention of losing the game. Like, no one's doing that. So I will give a negative and a positive. I think on the negative side, I have some questions about the end of game management. From a time and clock situation, from the team kind of losing their handle on things a lot in close games. And that was really a problem early in the year. And then they stopped playing close games and then they won a couple of those. And now it's kind of been back with the last couple games. It's certainly something that he can improve on. And I don't mean just the challenges. Like, challenges are noisy. He's been bad at them this year, but like Joe Mazzulla is always bad at them. There's not a lot of year-over-year correlation. I'm talking more like, time and score. Should you use a timeout here? Are you doing offense, defense substitutions? Is your team managing two for ones well? That kind of micro thing. The Raptors haven't been great at it. Getting better, but haven't been great at it. On the positive side, I think he has done a really, really good job through two difficult seasons, keeping guys bought in and together and energized and things like that. Scotty Barnes has improved a lot as a leader. The defense has gone from being like 27th over the first 2 months of the season to sixth over the last month and a half. That's a, maybe you win too many games or whatever, but you can see some progress with that. I don't know if the offensive system will be the way it is forever, but guys obviously buy in. They get a lot of assists. They're a good cutting team. Their bigs play well through high elbow DHO delay stuff. So you see that guys have held on to the rope. And last year was challenging for different reasons than this year, but guys have still held on and hasn't lost the room, hasn't lost Scotty, hasn't lost, RJ and Quickley and things like that. And I think that's a positive, and it's probably the biggest mark on a coaches, on his to-do list when you take over a rebuilding and developmental team. So that's good. And then, yeah, the in-between stuff is, we don't have enough sample, or the games haven't mattered that much. Like, do I really care how he used Kelly Olynyk in the rotation when they were just trying to get Kelly healthy enough to, maybe have some trade value? Not really. Do I think that going with an RJ plus four rookie or G League guys lineup for 4 minutes in the fourth quarter was the best decision if they wanted to win the Bulls game? No,
No.
probably not. Did they use Jakob Poeltl's minutes restriction like in a way that maybe helped them blow fourth quarter lead? Sure, but I don't think that's that stuff's a little hard to suss out. First of all, how unilateral that Darko decision that is, and how much that'll still be the case when wins actually matter. I do think he's the most fascinating person on the team for the first like 25 games of next year, though.
Yeah, just in terms of how they do and everything.
Yeah, and how we evaluate this stuff when the kind of not safety net, but the caveat of like, well, okay, you like I think everyone understands that not every decision he's making right now is with the intent of winning this game, winning this minute. There are developmental and trade value, and there are a lot of different things going on where winning each and every possession and every quarter and every game is not the highest priority that they have, even though they're competitive. So when that's gone, I'm interested. I also think it's interesting. It's a little awkward to put a guy on a bench that you might have to look over your shoulder at, but the entire coaching staff is pretty inexperienced from a head coaching standpoint. I think it would probably, as they move back to a competitive phase, probably behoove the organization to add an assistant who's, been at the head of a bench before an NBA bench, I should say, because some of them have G League international experience. Just to beef up the overall staff, I don't think would be the worst idea. So, yeah, I think I'm rooting for him. Like, I like him as a dude. I like talking basketball with him. I know the guys in the room really, really like him. And that stuff's important. I think the first like 25, 30 games of next year, when we can actually evaluate him without all these caveats, will be really interesting and really fun.
Gonna be an interesting off season in Toronto. Just one last thing. We met through Canada basketball, so I just want to somehow revisit just like how gut-wrenching that loss was this summer for the Mets.
Why? Why would you do that?
No, I guess maybe what's next for the program? I know that there's a little bit of time before anything of consequence. They made the AmeriCup a
Yeah.
couple of weeks ago, but like what do you see kind of the future of the program outside of obviously Shea, RJ, and Dylan Brooks kind of leaving?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you on the women's side, the last like week and a half has been nothing but Canadian college basketball woman just absolutely killing it. New career high, new record, all conference team, all rookie team, whatever. It's just like headline after headline of the Toby Fourniers of the world,
Oh.
just absolutely killing it. So I think the talent pipeline on the women's side is in tremendous shape. They obviously have to, like on the men's side, nail the head coaching job there. I think the Toronto Tempo coming in the WNBA will only help continue building the infrastructure and the interest in the sports. I think the women's side is in a really, really healthy place. They just got to nail that head coaching hire and continue to build with all this young talent. On the men's side, I'm really fascinated to see what the AmeriCup roster looks like this summer. I don't think you're going to get like Shea and Jamal and those guys out, but it would be, in my head, the way I think I would do it is a bit of a split roster where you want a couple of these younger NBA guys who you would like to have experience. You don't want the World Cup to be the first time playing, you know, in a major tournament for the national program. So you're looking like Omax, Shaedon Sharpe, even a Zach Edey, if you can get him from Memphis. A couple of those younger guys who are going to be fighting for, Edey wouldn't be fighting for a spot, but these other guys who could be fighting for a spot next World Cup. Next time the World Cup rolls around, I think getting those guys some reps in the program and some like reps with big roles in the program, it would be really nice. And then part of that roster, though, I think you should be looking ahead because FIBA World Cup qualifiers start in November, and those are in-season qualifiers. So you're not going to have your NBA guys, you're not going to have your very top European guys. I would want a couple guys on that roster who are, you know, probably going to be a part of that FIBA World Cup qualifying process over the next 2 seasons, because those teams. The team that played in Mexico and Dominican Republic a couple weeks ago, some good individual players, and shout out to them for going out. But like the program should be beyond sweating point differential against Mexico and Dominican Republic at this point. So that's, you know, like to start getting some names in there and figuring out what that looks like. They also have a head coaching thing to figure out. I think they've already said Nathaniel Mitchell's going to coach the AmeriCup team in the summer, so that's not as immediate, but you'd love to have that person in, have them out at the AmeriCup in Nicaragua, and you know, getting to know the team and getting to know the stuff, the guys. You know, I don't have like a full list of who they're talking to, or anything like that. You know, without interviewing the candidates or anything like that, I think JAMA makes a lot of sense as someone to at least be in the mix. You know, really, really well liked, good player development guy, head coach experience with the G League, has been a part of championship Raptors teams, championship programs in Golden State, a developmental situation here. Obviously, you know, Canadian, which is a, I don't think you have to have a Canadian, but not a bad tiebreaker
Nope.
there if you're looking at multiple candidates. So, you know, maybe he's in the mix. Nathaniel Mitchell, Gordie Hebert are as kind of, you know, Canadian candidates. You know, I think they'll probably cast a wide net internationally too, but be very fascinated to see how that one goes.
Well, Blake, thank you so much for giving us some of your valuable time and talking some basketball. I really appreciate it. And is there anything you want to kind of plug before I let you go from the Raptors show or, you know, anything that you're doing at sports?
No, I should just mention Scott Morrison too, because I left out
Yeah.
one Canadian coach in there. We're not going to do them all. We're not going to do swords and everything like that, but Scott Morrison is you know,
G League
another name
player.
there. Yeah, no, nothing to promote, anything like that. Raptor show is the Raptor show. We'll get into some March Madness stuff when that rolls around, which I think Matt is pretty excited about because as a guy who did a lot of college basketball, played in some March Madness, he's pretty fired up for that. And Florida's good, which I never get to hear the end of. Not that I'm like an anti-Florida guy, but like nobody cares how Queen's University and the University of British Columbia Thunderbirds are doing right now, you know?
Yeah, it's
So yeah,
actually.
we'll get fired up for that. That'll be fun. And then Jay sees it'll be here in a couple weeks.
Oh, Jay's season. Good luck. Good luck, Blake. But thank you so much for taking the time and doing this. And enjoy the rest of the Raptor season and Jay season.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me, and keep up the great work on the Sens. Can't say I hear it's great work. I can't say until the
That's
Sens
okay.
bottom out and there's Schadenfreude reasons
Yeah.
to be reading, I'm not locked in, but I do hope you get some good trade slop this week.
It's going to be interesting. They don't have much assets or cap space, but
That's right. I love to have no assets and be capped out.
I really hope that it's the Leafs sends first round. That's what I know our bosses at Sportsnet would not complain about that either. So
Yeah.
I'm
Yeah,
hoping.
take me back to high school. The last time the Leafs
Oh my
actually won
God.
playoff series with regularity.
Was it 4 and 5 years against the Sens? I think it was something.
Something like that, yeah. And I like just like irrationally dislike Daniel Alfredsson just because the Leafs ran into him in the playoffs area. And then after, like in retrospect, it's like Daniel Alfredsson was so sick, like not appreciating him for years and years. But that's what sports does do.
And Belfour.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Blake, and we'll do this again.
Yeah. All right. See you, buddy.